welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. There are a number of criminal justice reform proposals floating around the legislature this session. Among those proposals is one that would reform the system's approach towards fines, court costs, and assessments. Today, the Oklahoma court system is pretty much funded by the people who appear before them, civil litigants, as well as criminal defendants. In fact, the public defender's office that represents indigent defendants, they're funded by the fines and assessments their defendants are charged upon conviction or plea agreements. So are the district attorneys that prosecute the cases. Today, upwards of 12 different fees and assessments are tacked on to defendants in addition to court costs and fines. For example, pleading to a crime with a $500 fine could result in 3 to 4 times that amount in fees and assessments, placing indigent and poor defendants in financial jeopardy with the prospect of jail time or more jail time if they fall behind. My guests today are part of a working group to reform how fines, fees, and assessments are collected for people in poverty. James Hines is a longtime Tulsa attorney, as well as William Kello, who is also, for 8 years, a former district judge in Tulsa County, and he was the presiding district judge in the county as well. They're part of this working group to reform the state's criminal justice system's approach to fines and court fees. And they join us today on Studio Tulsa. Gentlemen, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you for having us.
Many have talked about the need to reform our criminal fine and fee system in Oklahoma for quite some time. But, you know, nothing has really been done in the last few years, and court systems are increasingly reliant on those fines for their operation. So why is now the time to reform this system?
Well, I think that there's something in the air. I've been involved in criminal justice matters for a long time, since about 2006 when I was elected as a district judge. And it seems to me that with the prior governor and our new governor Stitt and leadership in the legislature, criminal justice reform is really coming into its own. And I think there's some strong leadership in those areas. And the group that I'm now a part of felt like this was a good time to get together and discuss the problem that you mentioned and propose some legislation.
Well, James Hines, tell us a little about this working group. How did it come together?
Well, informal might be a polite name for our group, but we have discussed the problems that have arisen that we read about in the paper. And I had a couple of personal experiences that really impressed me that something really needed to be done. I have had a situation to put a personal face on the problem that I experienced down in the southern part of Oklahoma in a county on the Texas line in Murray County, where I was in court, and a young lady came into court, and she was led by a deputy, and the deputy introduced her to the judge, and the judge said, what brings you here today? And she was dressed in the prison attire, and she looked like she was in her 20s. She was a single mom. And the deputy spoke for her and said, well, she was arrested for driving a car without a proper license tag. And the deputy said that in the course of running the check on her, as they do, they discovered she had a warrant for unpaid court costs. The judge then asked her why she was driving a car with no license plate current on it. And she said, well, they were too expensive and she couldn't afford them. And she'd gone for apparently quite some time with not getting the license plates due to her economic circumstance. Her name was Susie. And Susie pleaded guilty to driving a car without a proper license tag on it, but they also added the charges of no driver's license and no insurance. The judge asked her why she was behind on her court payments for court costs, and she indicated that she had temporarily been unemployed, but she now had another job, and she was hopeful to get current. The judge indicated to her that you still can't drive a car without tags on it, proper tags. She said, well, I was just trying to get to work. The problem she was having with getting another tag was that you had to have insurance to get the tag. She didn't have insurance, and she was told by her insurance agent, we cannot give you insurance because you don't have a driver's license. Judge said, Susie, why don't you have a driver's license? She said, I don't know. The judge looked at the deputy. The deputy said it was most likely the cost administrator reported to her, the Department of Motor Vehicles. that automatically they will suspend a driver's license if you're behind on your court cost. And there was a payment schedule there. And anyway, she said that I couldn't get the tag because of that reason.
It sounds like it's a typical catch-22 situation once you get into that situation. Judge, is that something you saw in your courtroom quite often?
Yes, and my background was as a criminal felony judge, so I was involved in the assessment of fines and costs and, to some extent, the collection. And understand that in the criminal arena in Tulsa County and really across the state, at least 60% of the defendants are eligible for public defenders, which means they're indigent. Well, it's not difficult to forecast how receptive they are or what the ability of those individuals is going to be to pay the fines and costs that we assess. So these kinds of hardships that Jim is discussing occurred quite often.
So tell us a little bit about your reform ideas. Jim, start with you, if you will. I know one of the first things you think should happen, and it's the first part of this amendment that you're hoping to add to the legislature, is full disclosure of fees, costs, and assessments at the time of a plea, so a defendant knows how much is it going to cost.
Absolutely, and that has been a revelation made to defendants that is not consistently adhered to. And, Rich, so often the fine itself is kind of the tip of the iceberg. For example, a $500 fine for, say, DUI, there will likely be $2,000 in court costs. And there's a lot of little tentacles reaching into that group of court costs, and a lot of people want to keep those enforced. And I might point out that since 2003, these costs have increased by over 50%, which is, of course, way ahead of increase in wages and in inflation. And the real problem is two things, in my opinion. One, we're having what is the equivalent of a debtor's prison by putting people into jail for the non-willful payment of court costs, fines, fees, and assessments. And the other thing is that the court system itself is being funded 70 to 80% by the fines and costs taxed on the back of basically poor people. Among other problems is that we really have come up to a two-tiered system of justice in the criminal justice system. People that are of ordinary means are not going to spend a night in jail, most likely. They're going to write a check, and the check's going to get covered. But the people like this girl in Murray County down in southern Oklahoma, when she was led out of the courtroom, the deputy stopped and said, "Judge, remember that on top of your fees that you've and costs that you've put on her for new charges for no driver's license and no insurance, there's 4 days in jail at $50 a day." And this girl was drowning in debt. And there was not a lifeline being thrown to her, but there was more water being poured into the pool where she was swimming. It's just we need to identify and address the causes that have put debtors into prison in the past. And Judge Kello knows better than I do. I really just wasn't really aware of how serious it was.
I kind of went down a rabbit hole as I was preparing for this interview. I actually looked at the list of what makes up court costs, the fees and assessments. There are 13 different organizations that are receiving fees from the average misdemeanor or felony case, everything from fees for the DA counsel prosecution assessment, the sheriff's service fee for courthouse security, the Council on Law Enforcement Education and Training Assessment, that's CLEAT, assessment for a law library, assessment for the sheriff's service fee on arrest, any arrest they make, they receive a service fee, automated fingerprint ID system fee. You know, it just goes on and on. It's a huge number of fees, and I assume this is because the legislature has just not funded the criminal justice system in a way other than just saying, let's charge the people who are charged in court.
Yes, and Rich, it's very inefficient. There have been studies that have shown that this method of collection, which relies on the threat of incarceration or actual incarceration, is very ineffective. So what we're proposing is, as Jim started out telling you, a full disclosure, first of all, at the time of the plea, and then a series of reforms that won't eliminate those fees and costs. We're not here to understand or really to try to get the legislature to back off of those charges. Other people are working on that. What we're trying to do is just make a level playing field for the individual defendants. I would like to hasten to add this, though, that judges, and I hope I include myself when I was on the bench, do try to be fair. And the statute and the Rule 8, which is what governs our process for assessment and collection of fines and costs, give judges a tremendous amount of discretion. And most of the time, that discretion is wisely used, and individuals are treated appropriately in relationship to their circumstances. But I thought then, and I think now, that having a statutory regime that really sets it out in black and white is a much better system, and that's what we're trying to do.
Now, Rule 8 is basically a determination on when you have a defendant who's been found guilty or pled guilty. It's a system of determining whether they're able to pay the fines or the court costs?
Rule 8, yes. It's a rule of the Court of Criminal Appeals. Mm-hmm. And it contemplates that in every situation there can be a hearing to determine the ability of the defendant to pay. The problem is with the volume of cases that we have in Tulsa County and Oklahoma County and Cleveland County, that's a practical impossibility. And so typically defendants and their counsel will waive the right to a hearing on Rule 8. And if they actually insist on it, it's very unusual because the plea agreement itself has been entered into. The defendant and his counsel and the state have entered into a plea agreement. And once that has been established, it's just not very practical to assume that then there's going to be a hearing to determine the amount of fees that and fines and costs that should be imposed.
Because a lot of times that's already been hashed out in the plea agreement?
Or? Well, a portion of it has. Okay. The fines have been. But okay. The costs, which you were referring to a moment ago, those hidden costs have never been discussed typically and disclosed. And so one of our basic premises in this legislation is that kind of disclosure. I'd like to mention a few other points if I could.
Yeah, sure.
The process of giving notice to a defendant who is delinquent needs to be modified. What we're proposing is that notice be actually sent to the last known address of the defendant to at least give an opportunity possibly for a defendant to come forward and make arrangements to catch up on their fines and costs. If that is not successful, then a warrant can be issued for the arrest of the individual. But the warrant is limited to bringing that individual to court and not to assess the fines and costs by the warrant itself.
So how does it operate today? If you get behind in your payments and a warrant's issued, it's kind of like, okay, you got to settle up now today, or here's jail.
Yes, and some judges in some counties have used a rule of thumb where they figure out how much per day a person should sit in jail to so-called sit out their costs. And it's the statute doesn't provide for that, but it's sort of a standard operating procedure in some areas, not Tulsa County, I might add. But it can be if it's not addressed, and we think legislation is necessary. So the other thing we want to provide is that once an individual is arrested, they have an opportunity to go before a judge quickly, within 72 hours. Currently, an individual could be brought to jail, and sit for an indefinite period of time until they actually go in front of a judge to be able to have their fines, fees, and costs reduced or put on a different type of payment plan. We also want to have stronger language as to what is or is not a willful failure to pay. The law currently says that the failure to pay must be willful, but there's not enough teeth in that, and we think the language can be tightened up. And then in the event that an individual is actually convicted, or let's say found to be in willful contempt, willful nonpayment, the limitation of jail time should be 30 days. And then lastly is a series of changes that give the judges discretion on what they can do, and one of them is to create an opportunity for a civil judgment, not a criminal judgment. That is, the judge would have the right to convert the amount of fines and costs to a civil judgment where they would never be in jeopardy of jail again.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Well, my guests today are two Tulsa attorneys, James Hines and William Kello, former presiding district judge in Tulsa County. James Hines, also a longtime attorney here in the city, and they're part of a working group to reform the criminal justice system of fines and court costs. And I know, James Hines, one of your aspects is from that example you talked about was the idea of making the revocation or suspension of driver's license the last occurrence. Because that example you used, it's like if you don't have a car in Oklahoma, you can't work, you can't get to a job usually in an efficient or time-efficient manner. And that just sort of puts you at jeopardy of falling behind on any court costs you already have.
You're right, Rich, and it seems counterintuitive to take someone's license away and then say you need to maintain employment so you can pay off these costs. This girl lived in rural Oklahoma, and a good part of the people that are having these cost fines, fees imposed on them, and by the way, all what you read was absolutely true, and it's monumental, and there's many hands into this. And so if there's going to be any political pushback, it's going to come from the Sheriff's Organization, the Police Officers Association, the various courts that have a little bit of the revenue. And to follow up on what Judge Kello says, we're not suggesting that the revenue stop. We're not suggesting where the revenue should come from. But we're suggesting that if it goes into a civil judgment rather than a criminally enforced judgment over what basically are really civil charges, fines, fees, and costs should not be a part of a penalty. Or if they are, they should be put into the fines.
Again, it gets back into the idea of what's the punishment. And most of the time, it's going to be jail time, isn't it, for the most part?
That's the way it currently operates. That is the judge's only tool to collect and enforce these charges is the threat or the actual incarceration of people.
How often are criminal defendants and people who fall behind on their payment plan, how often are they jailed for that failure to pay the fines and court costs or when they get behind? Is it sort of a pretty ironclad rule that if you go before a judge and you're behind and you're in default or way behind, the typical response is, okay, you need to go to jail?
That's an excellent question. And the only answer I can give you is we don't know precisely. But throughout the 77 counties of Oklahoma, there is a great variation in that practice. And I would say this, again, based on my experience in Tulsa County, automatic incarceration is not what you could expect. But in some of the rural areas, it is. And what we believe is that there should be a uniform and clearly understood method of operation throughout the state.
And I assume it's oftentimes the judge's discretion?
It is the judge's discretion. And the cost administrative judge in Tulsa County typically has been what we call a special district judge. And they have they've done a good job, in my experience, in trying to balance the need for collection, which is rather dramatic because, as Jim said, the vast majority of our court system is funded by these costs and expenses. But they balance that against the obvious indigency of the defendants coming in front of them.
When you have an indigent defendant who's maybe made a plea agreement or has been found guilty, who has the burden of proof of saying, I can't pay? Is it the defendant at this point? And does your bill take this into account?
It does, Rich, and it is the defendant at this point. And in the proposed bill, we have proposed, if you're below the poverty level, that there's a rebuttable presumption that you are indigent and that the burden of proof should be on the fining authority to prove that. And if I could follow up just a little bit on this Rule 8 thing that the judge adequately mentioned and described, but I think it needs to be pointed out that in Rule 8, this is the last thing on a long form, and it is basically you come into court, the prosecutor and the defense attorney and the defendant come into court, and they've worked out a plea agreement. And that plea agreement presupposes you're going to waive the Rule 8 hearing. And the problem with that is, of course, the reason I propose it a very full disclosure, what your entire costs are, is the defendant is going to sign anything and plea to whatever he can plea to the best result to get out of jail. And your first time the defendant finds out that he actually has $2,500 obligation, legal financial obligations, is when he goes to the court administrator after he's pleaded guilty to a $500 fine.
Wow. So, I mean, it's literally when I go to make my first installment payment, they say, oh, no.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. And it sounds like Judge, you sort of alluded to this, because of your busy dockets or a judge's busy dockets, these Rule 8 hearings are a lot of time. And I think for a defendant, it may be, am I going to upset the court by slowing down the wheels of justice by asking for this? And I mean, it sounds like, because from what I've read, Rule 8, some courtrooms, it happens pretty regularly. Other courtrooms, it really doesn't.
That's true. This is the problem throughout the state. There's a variation in practice. And I'm not sure it's so much that the defendant is worried about upsetting the judge, but as Jim said, a plea agreement has been entered into which presupposes that the Rule 8 process will be waived. And the state could ostensibly say, well, if you want a Rule 8 hearing, we'll have to go back to square one and rethink this this plea offer. That's theoretically what could happen. So it's getting the cart before the horse to enter a plea without knowing exactly what the financial exposure is going to be.
Now, both of you gentlemen were very, very careful to say this is not changing the way the fines are administered. I mean, whether they're, you know, it's how it's paid, it's how it's adjudicated. And I'm assuming that this wouldn't have a whole lot of impact on court operations, because if you're really helping the people you say you are in this bill, they're not paying the fines in the first place.
Right. And I think that if we're fortunate enough in having this legislation passed in the next few years, it would be very interesting to see what the results are. Right now, they're not good. And I think that the Office of Administration of the Courts understands that. The Supreme Court understands it. And all of the district judges that I'm familiar with understand it. So now we just need to get the legislature behind us.
I've heard stories of this sort of revolving door where it's a non-payment or getting behind or losing a job, and all of a sudden you're back into court, you're either facing jail time or you're working out, and it's just sort of a revolving door. In your experience, Judge, did you have defendants where it was like, oh, you're back again, you know, what happened?
Yes. Short answer to your question. That's more common than not. Someone gets caught in a bind on these fines and costs, and they can't get out of it. And, you know, some middle-class or upper-middle-class defendants who are assessed $2,000, $2,500, they can write a check, and it'll be over. But the vast majority of criminal defendants just can't do that.
Hmm. Well, what are the next steps? You actually have a proposed bill in mind or amendment in mind to the existing criminal code. What's the process of getting this introduced? Because you're not legislators at this point. Are you talking to legislators?
We actually have submitted a proposed bill, and it was delivered last Friday. Judge Kello and myself were actually in conference about this as we handed it off to the individual that was supposed to deliver this, and hopefully it will be included in some legislation that's been presented this session. It was imperative that we get it in last Friday. If I might add that this has been determined back in 1983 under a case called Bearden versus Georgia, a 7-2 decision by the Supreme Court of the United States of America that says non-willful default on fines or court costs cannot result in people being put into jail or incarcerated because it violated the 14th Amendment of the Fundamental Due Process. Rich, you know, one of the things that just really got me in talking to various people that were subject to fines and court costs that they couldn't pay, they were having to make decisions on basic life necessities versus going to jail. And this girl that I was talking about in southern Oklahoma, I keep coming back to it, but it was such a human face on an existing problem. She had her children picked up by DHS while she was in jail, and then she also had imposed upon her child support payments, which DHS had a right to do. But you can see it was just like a circular drain, this vortex of drowning that she just can't get out of. There are actual studies that show that if people made the minimum payments on these fines, and of course it varies with the amount of fine and court costs that are imposed, but that they, if they never missed a payment, they might take them 20 years to make it. And another thing, and as Judge pointed out, you and I, the three of us, would not spend a night in jail, as I've already said. But this girl in Murray County, Oklahoma, is going to end up with the various accumulated charges and repeatedly being picked up and repeatedly losing jobs and repeatedly having her children picked up. She's going to be paying 3-4 times what we would pay. And these were for things that are maybe no more serious than traffic violations.
Hmm. If I could elaborate on one point you asked about the process, we have engaged the services of a person who we think will be able to help us in the legislative process, and there are bills pending which could be easily amended to accommodate what we're doing, which is a Section 983 of Title 22 of the Oklahoma statutes. And so we're also talking to other groups that are interested in this kind of thing, and the momentum is building.
I'm hearing a lot of talk about some serious comprehensive criminal justice reform, especially on this level. As you know, this is mostly on a county level or a district level. These folks are not going to the state penitentiary. They're in county jails for the most part, right?
That's correct. Yeah. And we're not trying to, again, upset the entire system of how the court system is funded. Others are looking into that. Our objective is to deal with this this problem, on, as Jim says, a human level, and also on a responsible due process level.
Yeah, and this is probably a first step to actually looking at a bigger system, which, again, these court costs and fees and assessments are really funding our court system in Oklahoma, are they not?
They are, and the legislature needs to step up and acknowledge their responsibility for these vital services that the courts provide.
Yeah. I think Jim was referring to 70 to 80%. I've heard more of an 80 to 90% figure for the budgets coming from fees and assessments. Well, it'll be very interesting to see. How do people get more information about this effort?
Well, they can certainly contact either me or Jim. We don't have a website, but I can assure you that if you look up William C. Kello and probably on James Hines and Google us, you'll find us. We're not an organization at this point, and I appreciate your asking that question. And we're not really raising funds. All we're doing is, as a small group of thoughtful citizens, trying to put together legislation that makes sense. We do welcome support, but at this point, we don't have any kind of formal structure that we can really talk about.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Two Tulsa attorneys, James Hines and former presiding district judge in Tulsa County, William Kello, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. They're part of a working group to reform the state's criminal justice system's approach to fines and court fees for the indigent and for people in poverty. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.